You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our
website. Hi, I'm Cory Doctorow, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Pacific Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on a special edition of the show, we welcome back Bill Meehan, co-founder of the American Indian Movement and the International Indian Treaty Council. Bill, of course, was an eyewitness to the FBI siege at Wounded Knee some 50 years ago. And we're going to be talking about all of this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, my name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, Happy New Year, and we are privileged and honored to welcome back to these airwaves a co-founder of the American Indian Movement, Mr. William Meehan. Bill Meehan, welcome back to Flashpoints. It is good to have you with us.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad to be here, and Happy New Year to the Bay Area and to the audience of KPFA.
Well, let's start with sort of global warming. Let's start with you. We were supposed to have you on a couple of days ago, but you all ended up in a few feet of snow. Tell us about snow and global warming. What's it been like?
Well, you know, we had a blizzard conditions, which out here means in South Dakota, high winds and a lot of snow. So it piles up pretty fast. And we just got over a little snow and another high wind the week before. So we had 10 days of off and on snow and high winds. And so it stacked up to the point where the vehicles there was no travel recommended at all, first of all, on the entire reservation. And even the Interstate 90, which goes clear across South Dakota, was closed for about, off and on for that 10 days as well. So we had a lot of people stuck on the highway, stuck in their cars. We even had some deaths here on the reservation. People that were not able to get to hospital in time. One was from the flu that I know of, not too far from where I'm living here in Rosebud. And so it was treacherous. And finally, the governor called in the National Guard. And so they came in and helped us dig ourselves out here in the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 days. They've been here, and so we're pretty much dug out, but they had helicopter. They dropped supplies off to people who were out in the country because, you know, this is rural America. And, of course, a lot of people are involved in raising cattle and or buffalo. The tribe has a big buffalo herd, which is something that I mentioned. We didn't lose one buffalo, but we lost several cows. Because the buffalo, you know, this kind of weather, they can stand it, they can handle it. But the cows, they can't do that. They got to have, of course, water. But the buffalo, they can figure out how to get to the water. And they can figure out, you know, how to feed themselves when it's not very much, not hay out or nothing, just off the ground. So anyway, that's kind of interesting that the buffalo, they face into the wind and still make it through. And the cows, they've got to head for cover, and they still die without any type of food or water. water especially. So there was a few cows that died, some people that died, and it was really a mess. And it was dangerous. And so we had a lot of our people out for several days, especially the ones that run the heavy equipment. And they didn't have no break until this past week here. So it was a lot of people that were running low on their fuel. Some burned wood, didn't have very much wood to last them. But anyway, we survived. Most of us survived. Like I said, there was about 2 or 3 deaths on this reservation for people that couldn't get out of their place in the country. And in time, so once he died from flu, and then he had COVID. So we had another lady that died from the COVID. And then a man, elder man, who also couldn't get out of his place and couldn't get to the hospital, and he also lost his life. But it was a miracle for some of the people that made it. And so far, we're just dealing with the after effects now and getting ready for another round of storms that are supposed to roll in here in about, another 24 hours. It hasn't stopped yet. So we just hope that, we're more prepared now because we had the little let up. So usually roads get closed and everybody stays home. But generally speaking, when that wind's blowing, that means the snow stacks up. So you get other problems of people's roofs leaking on these trailer houses, on some of these old houses, because they get heavy with that snow and causing different structural issues. So there's a lot of problems that blizzard brings along, and we hope that we're at least to the first two. Now we're waiting for the other one, but this one shouldn't have so much wind. When you get that Arctic wind, that's really hard on livestock as well as the people, because you have to have your heaters on all the time. So, you know, people are burning up their propane instead of cooking. They have to use it. Their stove goes out or something. They got to use that fuel for to keep the house warm. So you get, you know, people that run out of fuel. So hopefully we had these trucks coming around and filling people up. So I'm hoping we're more prepared this next go around.
Speaking with Mr. Bill Means. He's the co-founder of the American Indian Movement. In a little bit, we're going to talk about 50 years after the second Wounded Knee, but this is an incredibly important conversation, Bill, because again, it's sort of part of the way in which, if you will, the United States continue to practice genocide against the indigenous peoples of North America. There is a triple standard, and it really does come through when we're talking about blizzards or we're talking about pandemics. There's the United States government, and then there's the indigenous communities, and they're still breaking the treaties. How could you speak to that a little bit, Bill?
Well, you know, in the treaties that started in the big treaty that we signed, I should say the last one was not only agreed to by our people, but it was passed and ratified by the United States Senate. And also you have to recognize that in the U.S. Constitution, Article 6, it talks about treaty law is the supreme law of the land. Therefore, in terms of our legal standing, we are indeed nations within a nation, because treaties are signed between nations, not between organizations or tribes or any kind of a lesser, you might say, government, whether that's state, county, all that stuff. We're a government in and of ourselves, and we have all these authorities. We have some little bit of sovereignty left, but we have our own courts and things that make the society run. And so when these treaties are talked about, it's important to recognize that there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of acres that were illegally taken. Like, for example, the Black Hills, our sacred homeland, where we were created, our place of creation. is in the Black Hills at a place called Wind Cave. And so they're going all the way back to our creation story. Is one that we didn't come from any place else. This is where we were created as a nation of people. And so when you're talking about all these poor conditions that we live under now, it's only because the United States government controls all our resources. And, you know, all those resources they took out of the Black Hills, they mined gold there for about 150 years. And then they just stopped. Now they're back again into the Black Hills, and they're trying to control the water because they want to sell water to Denver, other places that are going dry. And so we have this powerful, biggest river in the United States known as the Missouri River. And a lot of people don't realize that. They think it's the Mississippi, but indeed the Missouri River is the longest river. So it plays an important part. It's actually our east border of our treaty lands. So we should be going all the way from the Black Hills in South Dakota and Wyoming all the way to the east bank of the Missouri River according to our treaty rights and our boundaries that were set in that treaty. So people began to understand the history of how we got to the place we're in on these small reservations. We went from a nation to, I think we have 11 reservations in South Dakota. And let's see, one in Nebraska, three in Minnesota, one in North Dakota, and let's see, one in Montana. And so, you know, there's a lot of reservations that make up our land and our history. So we shouldn't have to ask for anything. We should be some of the wealthiest people in the sense of, we don't say we all want to have $1 million, but we would like to have the benefits of the mining that was illegal. They still just went and imposed their will, and it's even proved in the Supreme Court of the United States, 1877, they passed a unilateral arbitrary law called the Black Hills Act without our consent. They just took the whole Black Hills, which is, you know, 17 million acres, and this resulted in us being robbed of our resources and put under the colonial governments of the United States and their Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so from that time of treaty making days, we were, you know, was put on reservation, forcibly removed to reservation. So we couldn't even leave the reservation for many years. Fortunately, fighting through our rights and all that, we're able to improve our conditions under civil rights, human rights, and fighting for the ideals of people just like the civil rights movement, that the blacks and the Chicano Americans, everybody had to fight for the rights. And we were part of that struggle in the 60s, 70s. And we began to surface again. People began to realize, hey, John Wayne didn't kill all the Indians. They're still alive out there on the plains.
Listen, let me jump in here for a second and let people know you're listening to a special edition of Flashpoints, a New Year's edition of Flashpoints. We're speaking, we have the honor of speaking with Mr. Bill Means. He's co-founder of the American Indian Movement and the International Indian Treaty Council. He's a master of knowledge on the trail of broken treaties that have been perpetrated against the indigenous communities of North America. And I say that advisedly. And I want to get to the 50 years after the Wounded Knee, but one more question. Let's talk about the nature of forced migration. We see the latest creation of U.S. nightmares at the U.S.-Mexico border. But I know, Bill, you see this a little bit differently in terms of forced migration. Who are the people who are being forced to migrate in? Well, how do you see the immigration problem, shall we say?
Well, I don't think we have a immigration problem. We have a migration of our relatives from the South because of the treachery and lost lands and the corruptness of the governments in Central South America. that used to be the, shall we say, the fruit basket for America, producing all the food and materials and a lot of the food and stuff for America. And yet, America allows those people through immigration. They call it immigration. We just say it's migration because those are our relatives. They were put here in this part of the world just like us by the Creator. They weren't brought here from Africa or nothing. These are indigenous people. So have their communities just like we do on a reservation, only they have no rights. Right now, they're still trying to struggle to get the right to vote and things like this. And places where they have those rights, we can mention a few being Peru and Bolivia and other places where the overwhelming majority is Indian. They run the government and have in certain times in this historical path that we're on. But from time to time, we have, you know, Indian governors and Indian presidents throughout the Americas. So in some ways, when they have the power of the vote, they're able to make, you know, fundamental change in where they live and how they get treated. So you have to realize that the Indian people throughout the Americas, the way we look at it, they're our relatives. They belong here. They were born here. So what's the matter if you want to go visit your relative? You should at least have an open door policy where they can come up and if they want citizenship, they should be able to do that. But the reason everybody wants to go home, I don't care where you're from. If you're from Alaska, if you're from the tip of South America, you have a home. And you love that home, and you want to be in that home and speak your own language and have your ceremonial ways and relate to the Creator. But yet, when we try to move across because of the condition and the robbery and death that took place in Central South America, we're looked upon as illegal aliens. Now, it couldn't be farther from the truth. Because, you know, like dope is illegal, and the alien, that's E.T. in them. So these are human beings, our relatives. And another example I like to use is the Statue of Liberty, which says, give me your tired, your hungry, et cetera, et cetera. But in our case, in a very racist policy, because it's Indians, you know, we got to have a border. We got to have a fence to keep them out instead of welcoming them in. We do a lot of work that the Americans don't want to do because either they don't make enough pay or it's seasonal or whatever. Well, we used to have just back and forth almost farm working communities that went to the same farm year after year. And they fought for their rights through the, you know, through the movement of the farm workers and those type of issues. But on the other hand, now today, another little historical look is during the 1800s, especially when we began to be forced on the reservations, they sent flyers, you know, posters, all this advertisement over to America, over to Europe that said, come to America, free land. We'll give you free land in America. That free land is our land. And so when they, at least these people coming over, they're not trying to take our land. They just want to be able to improve the living conditions under which they live, to be able to send their children to school, to have a decent job. These are the things that are they're seeking. They're not coming here to lay around like some people. They come here to work. And every case that I know, unless they're a criminal element, and now there's criminals all in all parts of society, not just people that come across the border.
So some of them are presidents.
It's very racist policy, man. So if it's white people coming, just like now, they're making special laws and special permits and extending various types of immigration to the Europeans that are involved in that war over there. And that Russia and the former Soviet Union is running out of their country over there. So it's just, like you said, a double standard of justice. One for the white people and one for us indigenous people. And as far as we're concerned, we should be able, as human beings, to make a policy that makes sense, to give people some dignity, give them a chance to get a job. They'll work.
That's exactly where we want to go now. Again, this is Dennis Francine with Bill Means. Also joining us, I believe now, is our own Miguel Gavilán Molina. I think Miguel wants to say Happy New Year. Are you with us, Miguel?
Absolutely. Both of you, Feliz Año Nuevo, and a big, good one coming to us. And now for a musical break.
And the rivers and the oceans and the streams are muddy brown, and the red and orange sunset turns to gray, and the sunlight gets dimmer as the haze falls all around, and the green and yellow hills have turned to clay. In a world without tomorrow, in a world that cannot last, I first in a world without tomorrow, my friend, that day is on its way. My friend, that day is coming back. And the trees are dead and barren, and the grass has turned to stone, and only man has caused it all. A victim of his greed and profit, now he stands alone, waiting to be the last one to fall. In a world without tomorrow, in a world that cannot last, in a world without tomorrow, my friend, that day, that day is coming fast.
This is Miguel Gavilán Molina. You're listening to Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein and Mr. Bill Means. Dennis, take it.
Yes. Now, Bill, can we? I really want to talk with you. It's 50 years since, I guess you'd say, the second Wounded Knee, and all the issues you have been raising here were confronted at that time in 73. Now, it happened through confrontations with, you referred to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the way in which the U.S. government tried to control indigenous communities through sort of infiltrators and folks they could control. And so that's where sort of that second Wounded Knee comes out of. So maybe you could talk a little bit, maybe you could talk about it this way. Remind us who Leonard Peltier is in the context of Wounded Knee, and why the United States government is still afraid of him and the FBI is still demanding that he stays behind bars all these years. Could you talk about that for us, Bill?
Well, one of the things about Leonard Peltier is he came to our reservation from another Indian nation in North Dakota. And so, but he had experience through what they call relocation, which was a government BIA program to take us into the inner cities from the reservation. And there train you in one of the skilled trades and so you could get a job, which the program itself wasn't bad, except that, of course, they put you in the worst hotels and you really did have to get out and get a job. So we went through then what the migrants are going through today, in the sense that we're stuck in the inner city. We had to depend on churches. We had to depend on the the gifts of people and show programs. So anyway, right now that's grown to 50% or mostly about 60% of all the Indians in the United States live in urban areas. And so that's a transition that took place during the 50s and 60s through the government policy of relocation. Now, for Leonard Peltier, he was one of those. But when he came to Wounded Knee and saw the conditions, and they had what they call a reign of terror going on at the time, there was a Pine Ridge, our reservation, had their own organization called the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization. They invited the American Indian movement into Pine Ridge. And, you know, a lot of us from Pine Ridge that went to other places or lived right on the res, we were part of the AIM already because we wanted to fight for our rights just like they were doing all over America, whether civil rights or Chicano rights, whatever it was. The 60s, 70s was a time when everybody was involved in some kind of a social change movement. So out of that came Wounded Knee, that spirit to say we're going to live like this anymore. We can do for ourselves, the spirit of self-determination. You know, let us alone. Let us have control over our education, our trade and commerce, those type of things that allow us to live an independent life. But no, the government wanted to control our land, made. They weren't satisfied yet with putting us on reservation. They wanted what little we had left. And so consequently, these tribal chairmen were put in place, which are almost exact replica of the, what you call the, you might say they're like dictators. You know, they have a small tribal government that doesn't listen to anyone except the person, tribal chairman that was in power. And so he wielded a lot of power and began a struggle between traditional Indian people that still wanted to, you know, speak their language, have their ceremonial ways and practice and live on the land, practice their way, their culture. And then there was people that lived in the agency, what we used to call hang around the fort Indians. They liked to be in the agency where all the jobs or what few there was controlled by the government and then passed on to the tribal leadership. So anyway, they during the time Wounded Knee, they created their own law enforcement. They called them goons. We called them goons. They called themselves guardians of the Oglala Nation. But if you use that acronym, then it turns into goons, which we felt they were like these small countries in Latin America where they set up their dictator and then they come in and rob the place of all their resources. Well, this was done on a smaller scale, just right in a reservation. So people weren't safe because if you were AIM, if you were part of the resistance, if you were part of the social change movement, then you were treated by these goon squads that were run by the tribal president. And so Peltier was part of the resistance that they asked AIM people, Oglala civil rights people, to come into their community to be like security, to be our little security for the elders and the people that were still chopping wood, that were living out on the reservation and had maybe a small farm, a small ranch or something that they lived on. And so these people of the tribal government decided that we were the enemy. So they started collaborating with the United States FBI and doing raids on these little small communities and hamlets. And next thing you know, the people of Oglala, which is one of our bigger communities on the Pine Ridge Reservation in southwestern South Dakota, they asked Leonard Peltier and a group of his people that he was traveling with to come to Oglala to set up a camp so they could be safe. So if anything happened there, they'd have something to stand up to the goons because there was basically no law and order at that time. So people were running around these little goon squads and oppressing people. They'd say, well, we don't need search warrants. They go in there, we're looking for ammunition, we're looking for fugitives, we're looking for guns. So we don't need a warrant. They knock, literally knock your door off the hinges, drag the old folks and the kids outside, make them lay on the ground. These are conditions that existed in this modern day, or at least in the 70s, on the reservation. And this was just Pine Ridge. This was in many places around the country. But anyway, so we decided, we as AIM and the Oklahoma Sioux Civil Rights Organization, to start standing up. And so we gladly put our people in different communities to act as security against loon squads and one-sided BIA police that were basically agents for the BIA and the FBI and all the various other jurisdiction police they had around here. So this under this type of, they call it the Reign of Terror, went on from 1973 to about 1978 during those times. And so all this lawlessness was going on. People couldn't hardly go to the store unless you were you went to the store in your area. So it was almost like the gangs in the cities do carve out a little territory. Well, so Peltier was part of the group at Oglala, South Dakota, that were resisting these policies and these actions by the Goon Squad, FBI, and all this. And so,
where did Richard Wilson, he was the chairman, I guess he was the guy that they was working with this intelligence. Tell us about Richard Wilson.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, he was the tribal president at the time. Like I said, they acted as agents of the United States Bureau of Indian Affairs, implementing the policies of the government. They were supposed to be, developing schools and taking care of the social programs as provided by the government, in which most of them were designed to fail anyway, as part of the whole colonial process that was set up many places around the world for indigenous peoples. But we had one right here where they'd have elections and stuff, the ballot boxes, all that stuff. So that corruptness was in the air. And so Peltier was part of the group in Oglala, a small hamlet on the north side of our reservation, in which they were acting as the security, and consequently the FBI invaded their camp. Went over the hill. They said they were looking for fugitives. They were looking for weapons. They opened fire on that camp. And subsequent to that, the men started running down to the camp from up on the hill, and they saved the women and children. And so they exchanged gunfire. And what happened was two FBI agents were killed, and an Indian man by the name of Joe Stuntz from the Northwest, he was also killed. And he was part of the security team by AIM that was in that community. They shot him full of holes. And so the rest, most of the people there, except the ones that lived there, they escaped. And so the saga of Leonard Peltier began, because he was one of those that was working as security, but he escaped out of there when FBI surrounded the place. They brought in U.S. Marshals, FBI, Border Patrol, same ones that were in Wounded Knee earlier in the month. And so all those things centered around Leonard Peltier, because they said he was the leader of the camp and he was well recognized. And most of the fugitives that they caught, including Dino Butler and this other young man, his name escaped me, they actually went to trial while Leonard Peltier was on the run for about, probably over a year or so. And he went to Canada. They illegally extradited him from Canada and brought him back to stand in federal court in South Dakota and North Dakota, where they could find, they used to have a policy amongst these federal judges around here where they went judge shopping. They found a nice racist judge up in North Dakota would try Leonard Peltier, because they knew they couldn't get a jury around this area or around South Dakota or in cities around South Dakota, because, a lot of the people were very, very supportive of the American Indian movement. because of Stan that we had taken in Wounded Knee, and because the message that we sent out that we have the right to control our own land, we have the right to self-determination, we have our own human rights standards that we were able to speak about, we have our treaty rights that binds our territory, all these things people could agree to or people could support when it got down to the issues. But of course the media, especially law enforcement, were painting us all as a bunch of outlaws and thugs and criminals. And so they criminalized the whole situation. So you couldn't hardly go into Rapid City, the town closest to our reservation, and you couldn't hardly go there to shop or anything. They'd be searching in your car, come and make everybody go, get out of the car and search your car before you could even come back to the reservation. So it was a constant pressure there during that reign of terror for the whole reservation and even throughout South Dakota. These things were happening on other reservations. And you saw how it culminated there all the way up until from Wounded Knee. The next big uprising was at Standing Rock, which was over water. They were trying to run a pipeline underneath of our water supply, which is the Missouri River. So it's always about land and resources, always. The United States and corporate America, what we call extractive industries, they want to go anywhere, anytime, and take whatever we have left and not have to pay us a penny, not have to even include us in on negotiations. So these are things we've been fighting for, and Leonard Peltier ended up being convicted after a long trial, and he's been in prison now for 46 years, I think is the latest count. And every time he comes up, we went through, I think, four presidents where he had a fairly good chance to get clemency or to be pardoned. But for some reason, one time the FBI even marched around the Supreme Court. They had their own protest march because they didn't want Leonard Peltier to get out of prison or pardoned by a president, because he exhausted all of his legal rights in terms of going to court over a period of probably the first 15 years or something it took to exhaust all his legal avenues of redress. So I think that's why he stands out as a political prisoner, not only here in our country, but throughout the world of indigenous peoples, and certainly people that believe in human rights. His case is well known. He's probably one of the most famous Indians in all of the world, indigenous people, because of his case and the conditions on what he was convicted for.
46 years in jail. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm hoping everybody can hear me. This is a special edition of show. We're speaking with Mr. William Means. He's a co-founder of the American Indian Movement and the International Indian Treaty Council. He knows everything there is to know about broken treaties and the treatment of the indigenous communities on this continent. And really around the world. I know Miguel would like to talk with you a little bit, ask you a question or two, maybe give you a bit of a hard time. Gavilan, are you with us?
Absolutely, Dennis. No, I just wanted to mention something that both you touched upon earlier, and that's the situation with global warming. The side effect of the corporate industrial nation that this country is and its extractions projects all over the world has caused a lot of the migration by turning those once luscious jungle lands, where people thrive, or Indian culture, Mayan culture thrived for centuries. In the last less than 100 years, the United Fruit Company has come into those areas. And of course, now with Starbucks and Peet's and all of these coffee companies literally fighting to get the lands in Central America. And in those areas, mountain-grown coffee beans are the best in the world, and they come from these areas. Well, after 50, 60 years of that, some of those lands are dead. They've been clear-cutted. They've been over-fertilized, over-pesticides, one crop, and now those lands are failing. Some of that migration is being caused, besides from the corruption of the government and the inhumane conditions that exist, it's also caused by droughts that are literally clearing the land, dying the land off, and people can no longer cultivate those lands to grow food. So they're coming north, and they're coming in droves. There's a new wave coming. And, of course, we know the U.S. policy. You know, the Biden administration policy, when he sent Kamala Harris down there a couple of years ago and said, don't come. You know, we saw that. It was just unreal. And then less than, what, 4 or 5 months, we saw over, I think it was 1,400 Ukrainians were allowed to come into the United States with a 1 to 2 day wait, passing tent after tent after tent, not only in Texas, but also here in San Diego, Tijuana, where, you know, thousands of refugees from political stability and refugees from drought and their lands no longer able to support or sustain life. So in all that, what can we hope for, Bill? You know, is there at some point, I know the Treaty Council takes issues to the United Nations. Is there at some point any consideration to send teams down into those areas, United Nations rapporteurs, and look at that area and bring some kind of solution, bring some kind of effort to rebuild those areas? And because if people have a means to their lands, a means to sustain themselves, they're not going to be fleeing. You know, people want to be home. People want to stay home. But when the land longer can sustain life, you know, they're going to try to find a way to a better life, to be able to feed their kids, have water, and lift their standard of living. Is there any hope in the near future where the UN might take something that the American Inhuman Treaty Council proposes to start addressing, you know, the effects of climate, global warming on the land and the people itself?
I think there's a standard that they set, what's called human rights. And so that's the area that we always are accepted in and we work in every day at the United Nations. But we have to remember, the people that control the United Nations, the UN Security Council, is made up of United States, Soviet Union, China, and all the major European countries. So what happens is those same countries that are exploiting indigenous people's lands are the ones that run the nations. And so they basically give you, window dressing or some kind of a very piecemeal type of address to the problem. Or a piecemeal way of dealing with the problem. You don't see like a massive program. Now, there is some good programs that some people are doing in those areas to restore the land, to fight for the rights, because they're not sitting back. But on the other hand, sometimes the resistance is brutally, and I mean brutally, without any care of women. Children, whatever, they'll go in and destroy a whole village with machine guns, you know, and things like that, rather than to try to use some kind of diplomatic approach. And then you have to pay, United States pays some of these countries to allow them in. So it's kind of a big corrupt machine that, you know, say, well, you give us access to the cadmium and the gold and the timber, and we'll let so many people come in and work with the Indian people or indigenous peoples. So it's always a trade-off.
Bill, can I ask you a question about the border? And, you know, you're somebody who deals with human rights at the national, international level. Do you think what we've seen in terms of the treatment at the border, the creation by the last administration and sustained by this one of Title 42, or is it Article Title 42, whatever it is, which really was a creation by the racists in the Trump administration to put an end to the ability to apply for asylum. So at so many different levels, we're seeing massive suffering, deportation, with these forced flights back to Haiti. Do you consider this crimes against humanity, or should these be considered at the international level?
Oh, yes, very much so. You know, our old people have for years, when I first went there, they said, we want to take our case to the World Court. But there again, the World Court is run by judges that are appointed by people like the United States and others. And so it's a very tough process to get those types of matters. And the way the World Court is set up, for example, you have to agree to be sued in there. In other words, both sides have to agree to that. So very seldom happens. Occasionally, there's a case that gets in there and comes out and makes worldwide news. But generally, it's not a place that's friendly to indigenous peoples or to peoples that are living on the land. And so we constantly dealing with this type of double standard of justice, you know, one for the non-Indian or non-indigenous and another standard for everybody else. So really frustrating to do that work, but people continue to do it, you know, whether you're Nelson Mandela, to spend 20-some years in prison himself to go come out of there and become a president of South Africa. Those type of stories are few and far between, but they are powerful. And indigenous people will always fight for our land and our rights and our identity. So the struggle goes on, but we're up against some horrific odds. We're up against some very corrupt people. And the corporations have more voice than the indigenous people. And that's probably the double standard, another way of putting it, because it's just that way in these big institutions like the UN and other places.
There are extraordinary stories like, you know, Miguel and I have been to the border, been to Tucson, covered the United Nations, taking testimony about the militarization at the U.S.-Mexico border, which is deadly for human beings and all other kinds of two-leggeds, four-leggeds, and the life at the border. We see, for instance, there are tribes that actually live on both sides who have their way of life crushed, and they end up under international custody, arrested for trespassing on land that their ancestors held for, you could say, forever.
Yeah, that's for sure, because I've been to those places as well. I know we worked with the Tono Oatum down there in Tucson, south of Tucson, Arizona. And they'd be able to, even in our time, they used to be able to walk back and forth because half the reservations in Mexico.
Yes.
So if they wanted to go to a hospital, they'd walk over and go to the clinic on the American side. But after facing all those years of various ranchers and people that want to take over the land and control it, you know, then the law comes in and makes a criminal out of you for wanting to walk on your own land, go to the clinic. So it's just from the practical issues of just trying to survive and everyday issues in the hospitals and other things. It's just atrocious of what our people have to go through to live in this country.
You know, it is amazing, Bill. I spent, I guess, over a year in my brief stint as a reporter for a mainstream newspaper called Newsday, and I covered the Tucson Sanctuary trial. And I literally went to a wedding that had the ceremony happened on the Mexico side of the border. This is south of Nogales. The wedding happened on the Mexican side of the border. And for the reception, we came over to the U.S. border, and life was, it was a seamless situation, but that has profoundly, even that has absolutely disappeared. It's turned into like a daily, if you will, corporate military crime scene.
Yeah, you know, a lot of that area has been militarized because of the fact of the amount of drugs and illegal activity that takes place down there because of the Americans have such an appetite for things like cocaine and, you know, fentanyl. They wouldn't be bringing it up here if they didn't have customers to sell it to. And I think that if they really wanted to shut it down, they could shut it down. You know, you can't hardly find a Cuban cigar anywhere in the United States, but you could find, you know, an ounce of coke within 20 minutes of going into the city anywhere along the border. And so these are things that the priorities of America, they don't really care about the human being aspect. They're always trying to use, they want the military down there to start arresting massive people, masses of migrants. I like to call them migrants because I don't think they're just moving from place to place looking for a better way of life, but and they're willing to work. And so I just say that, you know, they bring this facade of criminalization of everybody trying to come across as someone bad when we should have the welcome mat out, exact opposite, so that way people could come in a good flow. I mean, yeah, we're the biggest country that's here on this side of the continent. I mean, this side of the world, we're the biggest country that could, we could actually put together a policy that deals with these people.
Yes.
I mean, we got great thinkers and leaders in these educational institutions. If the government can't come up with a solution, maybe the educated people or others could work on the problem on behalf of our communities. But it's really, I don't know, it's almost as frustrating as working with the government.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let's, before we have to say goodbye, Miguel and I are really delighted to be able to speak with you and to continue to work with the American Indian Movement and to document the extraordinary work. It's time to Freeland at Peltier after 50 years after the founding of the American Indian Movement. It's amazing that the FBI can still, they're still terrified of this indigenous leader. So what's the plan to free Leonard Peltier?
Well, the plan, as I know it, is still, you know, we've exhausted all the legal means of trying to get him free through the courts. So the plan is right now they're asking for humanitarian release or just a straight pardon. But those things seem to be, they come up every few years in almost every administration, but they don't go nowhere because the FBI, they don't even know who Peltier is. There's, a lot of them weren't even born before Wounded Knee happened in 1973. So they don't know anything about it, but they still go and their wives, and they got organizations of FBI agents, former agents that they lobby. And they make sure that the government knows that all law enforcement doesn't want him released at all. And so then, consequently, we just go from, I guess, movement to movement, from time to time when there's a little light at the end of the tunnel that says maybe he has a chance. But it's been going on for 4 or 6 years. But there are people that work on his case every day. They just had a group of Indian ladies that were involved in the case ever since it started. And they went across Europe, you know, talking to Amnesty International chapters, et cetera, keeping his story alive. And they were very well received. And, you know, many petitions were launched over there that'll come back to the United States eventually. But it's just the idea that it's been going on so long. Let him live out his life, man, with his children and his grandchildren. And sometimes, like, he has some health problems that he'd be better off and going to a regular hospital instead of trying to beg for treatment inside of a prison. So it's just those type of things that make it frustrating to try to put an end to that.
Wow. Well, that's a real struggle that we're all very interested in being a part of. We've been spending the last hour or so with a good friend of this show, Mr. Bill Means. He's a co-founder of the American Indian Movement and the International Indian Treaty Council. We have been honored to be working with Bill for decades, trying to bring out information that is so oftentimes censored by the mainstream. We're hoping, Miguel and I are hoping to see you very soon. We only have 30 seconds left, but I just wanted to give Miguel a chance to say goodbye and really hello, because the plan is to come visit you all for the 50th commemoration and celebration of the Wounded Knee, the struggle for indigenous rights. Gavilan, you got 10 seconds.
Just real quickly, which will be happening, the 50th anniversary will be February the 24th to the 27th, and Flash Onda crew will be there broadcasting live. And it's always good to hear your voice, Bill. Si se puede.
Thank you very much. Pilamaya.
Bill, we appreciate it. Be safe. Talk soon.
Adios.
Up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conference unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify.